This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill Moyers has developed a devoted television audience by doing the type of programs that the experts say there's no audience for. His documentaries, specials, and reflective interviews have won just about every award in the books. Perhaps his most popular series was Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth. The Power of the Past is the subject of a new program that will debut on public TV Wednesday, November 28th. For this program, Moyers traveled to Florence, Italy, to examine the Renaissance and its influence on the present. Writer Umberto Eco and director Franco Zeffirelli are among the people Moyers speaks with on this program. From 1963 to 67, Moyers was a special assistant to President Johnson. Moyers has spent 19 years in broadcasting, alternating between CBS and PBS. Interviews on TV are often disparagingly referred to as talking heads. I asked Moyers if he was surprised that his had caught on.
I really wasn't that surprised because I never lost faith in the production value of the human eyes and the human voice and the human face, even though we were moving so deeply into a visual age. Also because growing up in the South, where conversation was a part of the hearth, and looking other people in the eye was a part of protocol, and where I knew people liked to listen to stories, I just simply had, it's built into me that democracy is a conversation and that people really do love to listen to other people and learn the oral tradition. As you know, in Fresh Air is such a part of our culture that if you find a way to keep it alive and keep it interesting, bring on people who have something to say, you'll find an audience.
You were ordained as a Baptist minister. How long did you actually preach?
Well, I didn't really preach. I studied to be a teacher. I laugh because you said to preach. I thought of the time I took my clergy mentor, Dr. Carlisle Marney, to the White House at a reception, and I kept introducing him as Dr. Marney. This is Dr. Marney. People thought he was a physician. Some lady said to him, "Oh, Dr. Marney, what do you practice?" And he drew himself up full 6 feet, 2 inches, and said, "Madam, I don't practice, I preach." I did more practicing than I did preaching. I wanted to be a teacher, and I thought in a religious institution. I did some student preaching on Sundays thanks to the tolerance of those congregations in the rural towns around the seminary and around the university. I remember once preaching a sermon on sin, and a farmer came up to me after it was over. All these were rural folks. These were small churches out in the country. He said, "Brother Moyers, you haven't sinned. You're not old enough to have sinned enough to preach about it." And you know, I really thought that's probably right. I'd better go out and sin a little.
So did you?
I did.
You want to tell us what you did when you made that decision?
I went into journalism. Isn't that
sin enough? Right. So you never really had a pulpit?
As a student. I would go out, and we would call student pastors. They'd give us on-the-job training, so to speak. And I had never more than 30, 35, 40 people in the congregation at a time. Good folk, farm folk, folk no longer there. I go back to visit some of the churches now. They're gone. I mean, the buildings are there, but the people are not there.
When you left the ministry, did you also leave the faith at all, or was your conviction as strong when you left?
Well, conviction is perhaps the wrong word for it. A commitment to grow was certainly there. I still consider myself a man of faith, although I think Joseph Campbell put it into perspective for me when I said to him one day in the interviews I did with him 2 or 3 years ago, "Well, you're a man of faith." He said, no, he said, "It's not faith that does it for me, it's experience, being in the world and then taking from those experiences your insights into God and into yourself and into that intersection where life and faith mix and meet and mingle and send you on your way to the next destination." Some of the simple premises of my childhood faith I've put behind me. As Paul says, "When I was a child, I spake as a child." But I'm not a child anymore, so I still consider myself a pilgrim, decidedly so. I would not want to be in this world without some sense of providence.
Bill Moyers is my guest. I'm sure you recognize his voice. And I should tell you that he has a new program that will premiere November 28th on public television. It's called The Power of the Past, Florence. I think you were in your 20s when you went to work for Lyndon Johnson and you became his special assistant. Was it like a father-son relationship that you had with him?
Not at first, and certainly I wouldn't want to characterize it as that because I wouldn't know what it was in his mind. I mean, we admired each other. I loved him. I think he came to have a kind of filial love toward me. But like all fathers and sons, if that is an apt analogy, we quarreled. We had our disagreements. We misunderstood each other. But I felt very close to him and miss him even to this day.
LBJ was an expert at power politics. Was that something you wanted to learn from him?
No, I grew up thinking of power as something that deeply involved the exercise of public service, that it was something that you did not for its own sake alone, but for the sake of what you could accomplish with it. I was a New Deal Democrat without knowing that's what I was. My father never talked about anybody but Franklin Roosevelt, never voted for anyone in his middle years except Franklin Roosevelt. I saw what the New Deal had done in East Texas to people in desperate plights, and so I was that kind of native Democrat. I never thought of politics as, you know, the exercise of power for the sake of power until I got to Washington.
There's certainly a lot of power politics that goes on behind the scenes in broadcasting. Do you feel that what you learned from Johnson in observing his use of power has been helpful for you in your career?
Probably much of what I've learned in my life has been by osmosis and not by explicit application of lessons drawn. And I suppose I picked up a great deal about how to get other people to accomplish my purpose with me, how to trade here and there in order to get what one wanted, but also to know that once you play the game for the sake of the game, you're finished as far as any fruitful purpose is concerned. And so I've never wanted to simply be at a network or be in the industry to simply be there. It's what I wanted to accomplish with it that I think being in Washington helped me to see and to do.
You were Johnson's press secretary.
And my credibility was so bad we couldn't believe our own leaks.
You couldn't what?
Believe our own leaks.
Well, you were the press secretary during part of the anti-war movement. Were your sympathies divided then?
Well, the first 2 years in the White House, I was Lyndon Johnson's political and legislative assistant, and I was responsible for helping to draw up all of those social programs that we put into effect, some with positive results and some with negative results. But that was my great interest. I paid no attention, wasn't asked by the president to pay any attention to Vietnam until it really had become much more than a cloud on the horizon. It had become a thunderstorm above us and around us. And as I became I became press secretary by default and by his insistence, even though I had told him at the time I really didn't want to do it. And I found myself not being a spokesman for the things that I really knew about and cared about, but ultimately becoming more and more an explainer of a war I did not myself understand, and a war which, while I supported, I wish I could go back and say I was a moral prophet and stood early against the war and said this is outrageous and wrong. But I wasn't. I went along. The president believed that what he was doing was necessary. The people he listened to, McGeorge Bundy and Bob McNamara and Dean Rusk, felt the same way too. Who was I, a 30-year-old, in the White House to really challenge those experts? My doubts begin to grow privately. I begin to be troubled, even though I could understand what the rationales were for the policies. I begin to wonder if the rationales were really true. And in time, I came to be unable to speak for the war as I had been. And ultimately, not for that reason only, I left 2 years before Johnson left Washington.
Were there things that you found hard to defend the president for?
Oh, sure. The president was given to outlandish exaggeration at times, like on a flight of imagination and rhetoric. While he was in Vietnam on a visit, he talked about how his grandfather, or great-grandfather, I think it was, had died at the Alamo. Well, I knew that. I never heard that story before, and when I researched it, I found that it didn't. He died in a hotel with an unnamed lady, maybe to cross the street from the Alamo, I don't know. But it was that sort of exaggeration, that sort of duplicity that became hard to rationalize and to explain. He was just a secretive man in that sense, part by his own upbringing and part by his experience in the Senate. I found that hard to rationalize.
I have to ask you something about what Morley Safer said about you in his recent book Flashbacks, which is a memoir about reporting in Vietnam. And he said that, in 1965, he did a report on how U.S. Marines torched the village of Cam Ne because it was believed that there were Viet Cong there. And he says, after the report, President Johnson called Frank Stanton, who was then the head of CBS, to criticize him for running the piece. And then in a meeting between Stanton, Johnson, and you, Johnson threatened that unless CBS fired Morley Safer, the White House would go public with information about Safer's communist ties. And Johnson said that you and he had the goods on Safer. And then Safer wrote that Johnson said that you and he had the goods as a result of an investigation launched by the FBI, the CIA, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and that later you had met with a CBS News correspondent who tried to smooth over the relationship between CBS News and the White House, and you snapped at him. His name was Murray Fromson, and said, "Why do you have to use a foreigner to cover the war?" Meaning that Safer was Canadian and not American. Safer says he found it hard to reconcile these actions with your role as public defender of the First Amendment and the rights of minorities. What's your reaction to his criticisms?
Well, first of all, Morley got it wrong. Morley was in Vietnam at the time, and anything he knew about that had to come secondhand. He was not in Washington. He was in Vietnam. Second, he's just flat wrong when he says that Lyndon Johnson called Frank Stanton down, and in a meeting with Stanton and me, that Johnson dressed him down and said all these things. I have a letter from Frank Stanton denying that. He has no recollection of that, and I can assure you he would have remembered that. He says it isn't true. I say it isn't true. Now, there's no question but that Lyndon Johnson railed and ranted against correspondents with whom he disagreed. There were two in particular that he found reasons to harass rhetorically, verbally. I never saw him do anything to try to discredit a correspondent, with malice, that sort of thing. He just lost his temper at them, and Morley was one of them for that report. I happened to have thought at the time that the report was a very good report. I saw it. I was sitting in the White House when I saw it, and it was one of those occasions when I realized that the war out there was different from how it was being presented in the official view of things. And Johnson would take on in a generic way any correspondent that he found telling a story at odds with the official view of reality. He railed about Morley Safer. He railed about Peter Arnett. He railed about Douglas Kiker of the Herald Tribune. He railed about Walter Lippmann and all of this. But did he call in Frank Stanton and dress him down? No, Morley has it wrong. And I wrote Morley to that effect. I told him that. I had the Frank Stanton wrote me. Morley had a chance to correct that in his book, and he didn't. Now, I don't know why he didn't. You have to ask him that. But he's got many of his facts wrong in there.
You started in television when you were 37 years old, after having worked as special assistant to Johnson and then after having served as publisher of Newsday. Since you started at the age of 37 and you hadn't come up through the ranks of television, did you feel like you'd have to make your mark in a way different from other reporters who came up through the ranks of TV?
No, I really wasn't conscious of that because, rightly or wrongly, the experience I had as a young man, as a teenager in high school and working full-time on the local newspaper, my work as assistant news editor of radio station KTBC in Austin when I was at the University of Texas, you know, I certainly hadn't been in the big time, but I had been a very good reporter. I had a lot of experience. I remember once when I was 17, the chairman of the school board called the publisher of the newspaper and said, "What in the world are you doing sending a student up here to cover the school board? He can't do that." And Mr. Cope, who was the publisher of the paper, said, "Give him a chance." And the next day, the long story about the school board meeting was as straightforward and as accurate and as complete as anyone would have expected from someone twice my age. So I was a good reporter and continued to think I would be a good reporter when I was in Washington. And coming back to journalism was, in fact, coming home.
You were really one of the few correspondents, I think, who I can think of from national TV, network TV, who've made their reputation doing interviews, among other things, but not combative interviews, you know?
Well, I'm not a very combative person. I'm more interested in you than I am in me. I'd rather be talking to you, drawing you out, finding out what it is you think, than I am in offering what I think. I mean, I do essays, I do documentaries. That you mentioned the special next on the 28th on Florence. The night before, there's a 90-minute special on Frontline that I have done called High Crimes and Misdemeanors, in which I take on, which I look at the role of Ronald Reagan and George Bush in the Iran-Contra scandal. I do have things to say, and I say them from time to time, but mostly I'm deeply curious about other people and other people's ideas. I was a good student in high school and college. I learned from wonderful teachers, and ever since then I've thought everyone is a teacher. You know, we journalists are generalists who are licensed to explain things we don't understand. And if we're going to explain them, we have to talk to people who know them, who can articulate them, who are passionate about ideas. And I just am turned on, so to speak, by people who love the language and can articulate their thoughts in ways that are compelling and which from which I learn and benefit and grow.
Perhaps your most popular series to date has been your public television series, The Power of Myth. It was a series of interviews with Joseph Campbell about myth, ritual, religion, art, psychology. After the success of the series, and the series was broadcast after Campbell's death, after the success of the series, Campbell posthumously became the subject of controversy for reportedly making anti-Semitic remarks and for taking certain anti-Semitic actions. Did you see evidence of that, and do you believe those charges?
I never saw evidence of it. I knew Joseph Campbell, knew him well for 11 years. I did 7 hours of television, 8 hours of television with him altogether. I have read every word he ever wrote. You will not find in any of his great works, Hero of a Thousand Faces, Masks of God, the anthology of mythology, you will find nothing that would reflect anyway the bigotry and anti-Semitism attributed to him by Brendan Gill. In the times that I knew him, the times that I was with him, in the times that my executive producer, Joan Connor, and others were with him, he never once reflected that. I was surprised when Brendan Gill wrote the piece. He gave only anecdotal evidence. He talked mainly about his conversations with Joseph Campbell at the Century Club. He offered nothing but his own personal recollections and a couple of other people he had talked to. And I cannot tell you that Joseph Campbell, when I didn't know him or when he was with Brendan Gill, didn't make remarks that he might well have been ashamed of. But I never heard him make them. There's nothing like that in his works. And he exhibited to me nothing that would justify that charge against him. And since Brendan Gill got wrong, the one thing I do know about Joseph Campbell, I happen to think he probably got that wrong too. For example, in the second half of that article you were talking about, he says that Campbell's idea of following your own bliss was responsible for the yuppiedom and Reaganism philosophy of the 80s of get it while you can and put yourself first and aggrandize your own interest. That is not what Joseph Campbell meant by follow your bliss. And Brendan Gill had read the book, read Joseph Campbell's books, and listened to the television series, he would have known that what he said about his philosophy was at odds with what he really believed. And if he got that wrong, he could have gotten the other charge wrong, too.
I always find that I'm shocked by everything I don't know about somebody, even people who I think I know very well, and I'm sure you found that to be the same, too. I'm wondering if indeed there was evidence that in parts of his life he evidenced some anti-Semitic actions or beliefs. How would you reconcile that with his other beliefs? Would you think that would negate his celebration of the complexity of the human spirit, or would it just be testimony to his own complexity and to the unpredictability of people?
Well, we're all out of a culture from which we're constantly trying to escape, and Joseph Campbell came out of a deeply Irish a culture with a sometimes justifiable hostility toward, biased against the British. He was a man of strong opinions. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that he might have uttered in moments, private moments, remarks that we wouldn't like. But he was not a person who did that publicly, or we would have known about it. And it tells me that, in the same sense that all the recent charges about Martin Luther King's plagiarism. Well, it says to me that he wasn't an original scholar, but at the moment when the time came for him to be used by Providence for a great purpose, he was there and he rose to the challenge. Now, I think the same thing is true of a Joseph Campbell. If he felt bigotry in his bones, if he felt prejudice toward anyone, he wrestled sufficiently to overcome those so that they were not reflected in his books. That, to me, is a testimony to a man's or woman's ability to deal inside with his own nature, his own intuitions, his own flaws and weaknesses.
So you'd forgive him for a certain degree of anti-Semitism?
I would forgive him for being a flawed human being, yes. As, you know, if he had been a flagrant anti-Semite who had used his scholarship and his public opportunities to express absolutely.
What if he used it to keep people out of, say, a dining club?
I would deplore that, but we'd have to then deplore most of the people we know above 60 years old in our society today, in the country, in the place where I grew up. Some of the, I do not understand the complexity of the human soul. Some of the best people I know, with a quote around best, belonged to segregated country clubs in the South where I grew up, still do today in many places, and yet they're deeply generous and thoughtful people. It takes a long time and a deep struggle to overcome your culture when your culture is confining and isolated and sometimes malicious. But I certainly wouldn't say, well, that changes his ability to compare religions in the world, or that undermines his scholarship, or that undermines his writing. It's only when you look at the writing, assess it, analyze it, apply it to your own life, that you have to ask, well, was he reflecting the kind of bigotry or the kind of prejudice that was alleged about him? And he wasn't. The same is true of other people I know.
Bill Moyers, your programs on television explore human complexity, and they take time to reflect on issues. They're more slowly paced, more contemplative than, you know, nearly anything else on television. But it seems to me that there's probably a paradox in your life that I think is probably a fairly common paradox for someone who would be in your position of doing reflective shows but in a high-pressure business, and that is that in your own life you probably don't have time to be that reflective or to take time. You probably have to be very fast, be very compulsive, and be very aggressive and assertive in order to get your programs on the air.
No,
not just in public television, but when you were at CBS.
Yeah, I sometimes have a reputation for being hard to work with, because in this business you have to fight constantly against a lot of inertia in order to accomplish what you want to do. Look, when you have an idea for a television show, it doesn't exist except in your mind. And there are so many forces you have to then organize in front of you to accomplish that idea, to take that idea out of your imagination and make it happen on the screen 3, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 months later, that you really do have to be purposeful, resourceful, stubborn, persistent, skillful, political, but always in the end determined not to compromise the idea that woke you up in the middle of the night and said, hey, I'm good, make me happen.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I really regret we're out of time.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for doing it. My guest has been Bill Moyers, and his new program on public television is called The Power of the Past, Florence, and it premieres on Wednesday, November 28th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.